You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 18th, 2015 at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Persephone and Nate join me to discuss the future of American labor unions and millennial workers. Then we talk about solutions against corporate tax avoidance. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio, as always, is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
And on the line from Michigan, filling in for Kelly this week, is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so Persephone, we have you on this week to talk about an issue that is near and dear to your heart, which Nate and I actually brought up at the very end of a segment a couple weeks ago. We were talking about Bernie Sanders and, you know, people who support Bernie Sanders, and then we kind of got a little bit to talking about, you know, millennial values and specifically unions, but we didn't really have time to go into depth on that. But I had sent you some weeks back an article that I read in The Atlantic, which I really liked, which was the title of that was Can Millennials Save Unions? And you are doing union organizing as a millennial. So I figured we should definitely have you back on the show to talk about that. I'm not really sure where we should start on this issue, but I guess the basic premise of this article, as I saw it, was that, you know, union membership, as we all know, has been in decline for quite some time. And, you know, still doesn't seem to be quite turning around exactly, but that the millennial generation seems more favorable toward unions themselves than the past couple generations, and more even broader than that, even if they don't identify as, you know, super pro union, or they're kind of indifferent, they identify with a lot of the values of unions, which means that if the unions were to sort of get the message out that those are the values that they have fought for, then more millennials might either join or be in solidarity with them. So I wanted to get your initial take first on the article, and then we can kind of talk about some of the stuff that you've been doing. So Persephone, what did you think when you read this article?
So when I read the article, I found it very interesting because a lot of my own work has been with higher ed locals. So it was interesting. I mean, although the article certainly mentions some of the higher ed locals, it also focuses on, Pete's workers at Pete's Coffee. And in terms of what the article is actually saying, there's a little bit of a conclusion that sort of talks about how, you know, just establishing a local is great, but it doesn't really result in a widespread labor movement. You know, it sort of concludes that some of the unionization will be what we've seen with Pete's or with Gawker Media. And I guess sort of my thoughts reading the article, I myself feel a lot of conflict in terms of, large national unions versus, small locals. Because on the one hand, I think that every small union, every local benefits from having a national affiliate to provide legal resources, to provide support, to provide like trained staff to help out. But on the other hand, I think that with efforts that are more small scale and are focused on, you know, specific places, it's also really important that it come from the worker. And I actually was talking with a staff organizer with my own, you know, for my own local, GEO, the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Michigan, about his work for a national union in where he was basically sent to different workplaces to organize the workforce there. And one of the things that he said was that he often felt as though his interests were in opposition with the interests of the workers, because occasionally he would go to workplaces that had a by and large positive relationship with management, And his job was essentially to establish, you know, negotiations. Now, my personal opinion is that I think every place should be unionized and that workers should have a say in the running of the company. But at the same time, I acknowledge that there are workplaces that are not unionized that have incredible benefits and that pay well. And so I think that it's important to stay focused and also to let these initiatives come from the workers and to make sure that people know what they're getting into during unionization efforts. And it's important that people know the risks. With that said, I am very supportive of these kinds of efforts. So I think that I'm happy to hear about these particular examples because it gives me a lot of hope. Unlike the writer who seems to be talking about how, you know, unionizing on a small scale doesn't make that much of a difference, I actually think that unionizing on a small scale does a lot to empower workers and to help them understand how labor works, and that it's more beneficial to the people involved in these efforts than it would be if a larger union comes in and sort of establishes itself through the workers, but like not through their own initiative, if that makes sense. So I think that what we see here is really an example of activist training. You know, these people are learning these skills. They're learning how to organize. They're learning how to talk to people about their wages and about their living conditions. And I think that's really important, especially right now when we have huge amounts of income inequality, and having those conversations is really important.
Yeah, I think the Gawker example is pretty big here. You know, we have this like large multimedia company with a bunch of different you know, branches for different topics and whatever. They have like sports thing, a feminism site, and all that. So it's pretty broad based, popular website. And as you said, they are, you know, they've started undergoing unions. They're, I guess they're doing it very quickly. So they're still not quite sure how everything's going to turn out, but I mean, that was an initiative. People were in support of joining that, and that, I guess that's a pretty big step forward if we're talking about how to set up unions in the sort of postmodern, you know, post-industrial working age where you have a lot of new media jobs or service jobs, things like that. So, you know, they, you know, and of course this Atlantic article tells a story of a young woman working at Pete's Coffee and her struggles to try to unionize. So I think those are the, I guess, the two big areas where, you know, this sort of pushing for unions might have to come from. So, for example, the Gawkers are now under the Writers Guild of America East, I guess. So they just joined a pre-existing larger union. Another thing I think we should focus on is just the attitudes of millennials towards the ideas or sort of values of unions. And there was a study quoted in this Atlantic article talking about PricewaterhouseCoopers. In 2013, they had a study trying to figure out why their younger workers were leaving in the first few years of employment instead of working, I'm quoting, working diligently for years in order to climb the corporate ladder. And they basically found out they wanted more flexibility, more transparent compensation, promotion structures. They wanted a team-oriented culture. They felt keeping up with the high demands of work weren't worth sacrifices of their personal lives. I mean, I know someone who works at PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's in, you know, it's very demanding. They work, you know, insane hours. So it looks like, and the article notes, without discussing unions at all, the firm had found that younger unions share concerns for some of the very things that unions have sought for generations. So it's not like younger people don't care about the things that unions care about. In fact, I mean, these are just the common demands of workers. They don't want to have to, you know, work for uncertain wages and uncertain hours, you know, very long amounts of time, and then not get the sort of structure they need at work. So I think we are seeing amongst millennials the values and ideas necessary for forming unions.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, a lot of the themes that came up in this research was that those ideas about flexibility, work-life balance, those kind of things. And we don't necessarily think of those as being union activities because, you know, unions are portrayed as, in the United States especially, as like disruptive strikers or whatever. But I mean, things like getting weekends off and stuff like that, I mean, that's a work-life balance thing. That's a, you know, time demand, you know, flexibility type of thing that unions really pushed for back in the day. And, you know, you can say, and I think this is, you know, honestly, this is one of the, I think the unions have the same problem that a lot of the organizations have, you know, all across, especially on the left and the Democratic Party as well. It's this tendency to be like, hey, we got all this awesome stuff done like 70 years ago or 90 years ago or 100 years ago. And you're just like, okay, and then what did you do? Which I'm not saying unions haven't been doing anything, but like they're not good enough at promoting like, you know, this is what we've done since then. This is what we're going to do next. This is our next step. This is like the next big area. I mean, they, you know, we see maybe pushing for things like, you know, $15 minimum wage, things like that. But like, that's fairly recent. And even that's like, you know, relatively incremental as those things go.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that this is another issue, right, that's sort of national versus local. I mean, I think that people who are part of an already organized workforce, right, and are considering whether or not to join a union or whatever, they have the example of what their specific local has done for their specific workforce, right? So if I'm trying to get somebody to join GEO, I can say, well, do you like having no copays on your health insurance? That's something that we won. Do you like having job security where if the university withdraws like an appointment and decides you're not going to teach, you still get all the benefits and pay that you would otherwise have gotten? That's something that we won through bargaining. And like that every round they try to take away. So I can give concrete examples that are very focused on the individual. But if you're looking at like, oh, like AFT in general, what have they done? Or what has the AFL-CIO done? Or what has AFSCME done? Or whatever. It's a lot harder to pinpoint because we've just been looking at so much deunionization. We've been looking at a lot of workplaces that once were unionized no longer being unionized. And this also leads into another problem that unions face, and that's that most young people don't have any familiarity with unions. I mean, first of all, a lot of lower paying workforces are not unionized anymore. And then a lot of middle class people have no experience with them. So once you get to, you know, anybody who is in higher education, for example, I'm using my own sort of situation, right? Most people in our union, they don't have a family member who was in a union. They themselves have not been in a union. And that's true, I think, for most young people. Now is that we don't have these connections to unions and we don't understand how they operate. And I think that one of the things, I mean, we've seen that a lot of the techniques of activists in our parents' and grandparents' generations no longer work, right? Like sit-ins are much less effective than they used to be. You know, a lot of protests don't get coverage. They don't get the kind of attention they once did, and they don't achieve the same ends. So when we think about unions, we often associate it with, oh, like a really long time ago, going on strike worked, or a really long time ago, those techniques worked. And we look at unions from the perspective of techniques, which is kind of what you were talking about earlier, right? The idea of, oh, a union is something that strikes. But the reality is that they're changing organizations and that they are using all kinds of techniques. I did, this past summer, I attended Cornell and the AFL-CIO's Strategic Corporate Research Summer School, where we looked at using corporate research as a way of winning a union campaign. So understanding how corporations operate as a way of understanding how to achieve specific goals. And unions also operate under the legal system, right? We have the National Labor Relations Board, which sometimes is better than others. And we have people with contracts, you know, unions that are negotiating contracts and that are that have the legal power to enforce those contracts. So I think the really important thing in terms of millennials and unions is getting the message out there that unions are very effective when they have the support of the membership.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the sort of strongest unions at this point, unfortunately, tends to be the various police officers unions. You know, that's not exactly the example that I want to be touting here, but like they certainly are powerful. You know, whenever some police officer gets in trouble, whether they're you know, shouldn't be in trouble or did something very bad, they, you know, contact their union rep, and that's the person who's advocating for them and standing up for them. And, you know, so, but on the other hand, that can leave people with a bad taste in their mouth regarding unions. And I think that's true for some of the other unions too, right? If you only associate it with, you know, stuff like striking, and you don't really understand what the, you know, maybe if you're lucky, there's coverage of the strike, but there's never any coverage of what led up to the strike. Then you just have this negative association of like, well, these people are disrupting my life and I don't know why. And the, you know, they may not even end up getting what they want because unions have been so weakened. So, you know, we need to, like you said, come up with those local examples and really tout that. I think that sort of speaks to this need to, and I think this was expressed in the Atlantic article, sort of decentralize unions to some degree, of saying like, you know, like, let's not introduce a hostile work environment just because we're trying to, like, you know, set up a union here. Like, it's important to set up a union, but we've got to find a way of doing that that is locally relevant and applicable without suddenly introducing hostility between the workers and the managers. You know, anything that can sort of empower those local forces is probably going to be more productive than just coming in as a national entity without regard to what the facts on the ground are. I mean, that's sort of another millennial thing, is decentralizing things and you know, going to the local level wherever possible, because that's how you, you know, get stuff done, I guess. And those are the people that you know and want to work with and everything.
Absolutely. And I think one example of this that's been really successful is Cornell, where the graduate students organized, and they said, we're not going to affiliate unless we get what we want from the affiliate. So they were actually kind of negotiating with UAW and AFT in terms of who got to sort of, in quotation marks, claim them as part like of the larger union. So they were really focusing on making sure that their local had a huge amount of power in and of itself before affiliating with a larger union. And I think that things like that really help. It's really important. I mean, I think that as small as a local may be, it still benefits from a national affiliate.
Right.
But there are dangers with that, and it's important that these locals really consider what affiliate will give them what they most need for their specific group of people.
We've talked a little bit about antagonism. We've talked about media coverage. That seems to be another challenge as well, is that the media doesn't cover, if they cover unions at all, it tends to be pretty negative. And that, you know, there's a long, complicated history behind why that is. But, you know, it used to be, as I'm told at least, that a lot of journalists used to be unionized, and they were therefore relatively pro-union, or at least somewhat pro-union, rather than being sort of like openly hostile to it. But I think, as we've talked a little bit about in the past, and Nate, you might want to speak to this somewhat as well, but, you know, there's been a change in who is a journalist in America, right? The financial circumstances of how to become a journalist and going through journalism school and all that has changed. And so there is not really as much unionization in the newsroom these days, which, you know, perhaps they could benefit from, given all the, you know, crazy cuts and everything all over the country in newsrooms. But it's a different set of people that cover unions these days than used to be.
Yeah, I mean, just speaking to that, connecting it to the Gawker discussion earlier, for a lot of people, that is journalism now, and that is, you know, where they're getting their content or whatever. You know, maybe it's not necessarily hard news, but it's pop culture, it's sports, it's whatever. So, I mean, I think that is a step forward pretty significantly. But yeah, I mean, there has been broad overall decline in sort of like newspapers and the sort of newsroom where you would might have unions in the past. But I guess the, as I said, the Gawker could be a step forward for other sort of new media sites to actually engage in sort of the union discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I hesitate to bring up Volkswagen America right now because of all the scandal that's going on there, but we have talked about in the past that one of the things that they were trying to do in the U.S. division of Volkswagen was to introduce some of the elements of the German industrial labor relations, basically setting up things like a works council and all that. And the idea there, I mean, it wasn't as radical as in Germany, where they literally have people from the union on the board of directors. But the idea there, which has been very economically successful for German companies, is to basically say, like, well, we need people who are advocating for the workers, but do they necessarily have to be antagonistic in that advocacy? And, you know, I think Persephone, you might be able to answer this as well, but I think there's still a big debate as to what the role of unions is. Is it to be, just an advocate or an antagonistic advocate specifically? And that sort of gets back to that issue of, well, what if there's not hostility already there? You know, how do you sell a union? How do you pitch a union? I almost wonder if some of these newsrooms had been unionized in the past couple, decades or even just the past 15 years and had non-antagonistic unions, but like cooperative unions, maybe they could have avoided some of these situations by basically, inviting them into the discussions on, hey, the face of the newspaper industry is changing. You know, we're losing all this, classified ad revenue to online ads, things like that. All the prices of ads are going down in general. Some of the newspapers maybe are struggling for stupid reasons, but some of them are definitely struggling for pretty legitimate reasons. And, inviting the union into the discussion on that, if there were a strong union in some of those newsrooms, maybe could have helped kind of cooperate on finding effective solutions to these challenges, in a way that could actually, try to fix them and not just have every solution be a massive round of layoffs that then further decreases the coverage and quality of coverage, and then people, unsubscribe even more. That's just sort of throwing out an idea there. What do you think about that issue, though, Persephone, about the advocacy versus antagonistic advocacy?
I think that the relationship doesn't have to be antagonistic, and I think that certainly some organizations, some companies and corporations understand that, and they see unions as an opportunity to sort of standardize things among all their workers. We have the example of, I think it was Volkswagen, that actually had to fight some right-to-work laws because they wanted their workers to have a union. They were used to just talking to unions directly and arranging things through unions. And that was just their system that they had in place. I think that there are still a few companies out there and that see the advantage of that and that kind of appreciate having a single contract for everyone. It does standardize things. So I think that there are ways in which unions can be useful to management. Now, realistically, unions are about workers' rights. And one of the things that unions are always going to ask for is higher pay for their workers, which isn't something that most companies are okay with. It does impact their profits. So there always are going to be opposing interests, unless it's specifically a company that benefits off of having an ethical labor image, right? So right. I could see certain companies that are specifically about, political sort of companies or companies that are always about fair trade or about other things. Those kinds of companies, I think, benefit even from these opposing interests, right? They want to give people better wages because then they can put a union labor sticker on their products. Right. At the same time, in terms of just management more generally, I think that the antagonism, and I'm talking here about real antagonism and not just we really don't want a 2%, wage increase or something like that, but like real hostility, massive layoffs, massive firings, attacks on union activists. That is something that's emerged, that's resurfaced, I should say, in recent years. And I don't think it has to be that way, but I think a lot of it has to do with how corporations see themselves and see each other. I think that we've entered a period where the competition is so high that they can't even afford to consider unions in a positive way. They can't even every corporation that has a strong presence has to prove to its shareholders, right, that it is successful and it does this with profits. And so even if they're still making huge amounts of money, if their profits are less than those of a different similar corporation, then that's not going to look so great for them. And I think that's actually a lot of it.
Yeah, and I mean, that gets into certainly the shareholder revolution and everything that we've criticized extensively on the show, right? The emphasis that you can have a very productive and successful company that runs very close to the margins, but you can't do that when it's supposed to be generating bigger and bigger profits every single quarter to, you know, these billionaires that own most of the shares. And that's certainly a challenge. The other thing that I was thinking of is you mentioned several times standardization, and you said, you know, that's beneficial for the companies, and also it's not always beneficial for the workers. Well, at least you were sort of implying that. And that sort of came up a little bit in the article. But one of the things that the article made me think about was we need to kind of rethink what the word standardization means when we're talking about a union contract or something, right? Because I think there's the perception that that means every single worker gets the exact same deal, right? The exact same pay, the exact same benefits, the exact same perks or whatever. And I think we need to, and this is something that I think unions also need to rethink, especially because millennials, the values that they want are things like, you know, better options for taking off time to be with family, better options for, you know, work environment, all these different things that they want, more flexibility, right? And you would see, it would seem like, oh, individual flexibility, that's oppositional to standardization. However, what I think that the unions could be doing, and I'm sure some of them are, but they could be doing this more widely and promoting it as such, is basically offering standard packages so that everyone has the same options available to them, right? But they don't necessarily, it's not like every single person gets, you know, is compensated exactly the same or has exactly the same benefits, but everything is available to them, and then they could choose, you know, which one works for them and which one doesn't. There, you know, there'd be a trade-off. Like if you get, you know, if you take more vacation days, then you get something less of, you know, some other thing. That would be a way of giving everyone those options that I think also ties into any number of other issues that are important to people, especially on the left. You know, for example, family and medical leave. Traditionally, that's been associated with, you know, a feminist issue, but think more broadly, right? Give the male workers and the female workers both, you know, parental leave opportunities in their contract, right? That's a standardized thing. You're not saying, oh, the women need a different contract than the men. You're saying these are the same options. And then you could have, like I said, you could have that flexibility element where some guy who's not going to need that, you know, parental leave, or some mom who's not going to need that parental leave option because they've got a different situation than someone else who's a similar worker but has a different home life situation, right? You could then make a trade of saying, okay, I don't need that thing, but I do need this other thing, right? Basically giving people a standard set of options to choose from. That, I think, could be really an innovation in how unions negotiate on behalf of workers, and a thing that would make a lot of workers interested in participating in unions. So it wouldn't be that everyone has an identical contract. It's that everyone has identical options presented to them and then chooses which ones fit best for them.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And I think that that would benefit people a lot. One concern that I might have is, of course, that it can enter into some of the same issues that necessitate the need for childcare in the first place, right? So you're kind of telling parents, you know, potentially telling parents, oh, well, you can do the childcare, but then you're going to give up not having co-pays or something like that, or, you know, things like that. So there are certain, having a trade-off could still create an unequal situation. But in terms of standardization, though, what you mentioned about, you know, childcare and things like that brings up a really important point, and that's that in unionized workforces, there's less of a gap. There's less of a wage gap, both on racial lines and gender lines. So we see a much smaller income gap between those workers. And I think part of that is that individuals negotiating for themselves have to be not only good at negotiations, but also have to come across in a certain way. And at the end of the day, there's going to be discrimination with one-on-one negotiations anytime that a woman or a person of color is standing up for themselves and trying to get more pay. So when we talk about standardization, it might sound kind of like, oh, well, you know, everybody is getting the same thing regardless of whatever else. But actually what it means is that people are not getting different pay or different benefits simply because they're a woman or because they're a person of color, that we get much fairer workplace conditions for everyone.
This is going to be a long, just I guess, journey of trying to rebuild the union infrastructure that's sort of been torn down over the past, you know, 40, 50 years, and try to get it to more generally reflect the 21st century economy, whereas right now maybe it's not as much more focused. The unions that remain stronger and more labor, industrial type labor jobs or things like that. So you need to, I guess, expand the reach of unions, try to get younger people more involved and actually caring about them. And then hopefully they can sort of return to their place in the political discourse, or at least strengthen it, because as we've seen, they've been weak in the past couple decades.
All right, well, we are going to go to a break now. So stick around. We'll be right back with more from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Still on the line with us from Michigan is Persephone. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about a post that I put up a couple weeks ago on ArsenalForDemocracy.com. Headline, Fortune 500 firms may have avoided $620 billion in recent taxes. So a few weeks ago, we talked on the show about new ways to get money that don't involve just saying, let's cut the defense budget, right? Because maybe that's a legitimate priority, but people don't want to hear that. So let's talk about finding money in other places. We talked about hundreds of billions of dollars that were being given away in tax breaks to wealthy individuals for things like mortgage credits and stuff like that. But I want to talk now about a new Citizens for Tax Justice and U.S. PIRG study of IRS and SEC filings that indicated that 358 of the 500 largest companies in the United States are stashing $2.1 trillion in legal tax havens offshore, mostly places like Bahamas and Cayman Islands. The lost U.S. revenue from just 57 of them who admitted the difference in what they would have paid on those profits without havens versus what they actually legally paid was $184.4 billion in total. This report then extrapolates that out over the entire Fortune 500 companies and says that if those numbers hold true for the rest of the Fortune 500 companies, that means that the top 500 largest companies in the United States have skipped out on paying $620 billion in total, or $90 billion a year over the period, which was like, you know, 2008 to 2014. So $90 billion a year during that period just was supposed to go to the United States, belongs to we the people, right? And then didn't. And I say that it belongs to we the people. Some people don't like that because they don't think of taxes in that way. But that is literally what the taxes are, right? They are going to pay for the government, which is not an entity, it's an activity. Government is our collective action for governing. And that means that the money that is being put into these tax havens and is not being taxed as it should be, is not paying for things that we need, like highways and satellites and all these other things that these companies benefit from tremendously. These are public investments. We need money to pay for them. And these companies are not paying for them. $90 billion a year going down the drain that should be going to us. And we've talked about this as well previously on the show. The reason that these companies are making such gigantic profits is because they are not compensating their workers very well, and they are especially not increasing the compensation for workers according to increases in productivity. That means that they are stealing this money twice from we the people. Once on the payment side, the compensation side for workers, and again on not paying it in taxes. So by hook or by crook, they ought to be paying this, and they are doing neither. They are legally stashing these in offshore tax havens. This is what we call tax avoidance. Legal tax evasion is called tax avoidance. And recently, the head of the World Bank, which is not exactly, you know, a leftist organization, said that tax avoidance schemes are a form of legalized corruption. Nate, I want to go to you for your perspective on this.
Jim Yong Kim, president of the World Bank, former president of Dartmouth College, he said that some companies use elaborate strategies not to pay taxes in the countries that they work, and it's a form of corruption that hurts the poor. Basically said this in a World Bank meeting, IMF meeting in Lima, Peru. So he's according to a UN report, tax evasion is costing an estimated $100 billion and lost public revenues in poor countries. So he's talking about the poor countries too. So we're not just talking about the U.S. and its budget deficit and, you know, where are these resources that we could be using to fund programs here at home. It's also about you know, you have these countries or companies that are investing in poor developing countries, and the people aren't getting the revenue from those companies. I mean, just being, you know, thrown back over to the account back in the Caymans or wherever, Bermuda.
Now, he was talking about countries like Namibia or wherever, right? Some sub-Saharan African country, for example. But this can also be applied, in my opinion, to developed nations like the United States. We're not able to pay for these projects because this money is being stolen through legal means. Persephone, what did you think of this post and this report?
Not surprised. I think that they will do, a lot of these corporations will do whatever they can to avoid paying taxes. Now, it's unfortunate that this is all through legal means. And I think that clearly the thing to do is to crack down on that and to close up some of these loopholes. At the same time, when I think of recent efforts to do this that have resulted in, for instance, the inability of any U.S. citizen to open an account in any, in like many European countries, right, where they have gotten to the point of just refusing bank accounts to any U.S. citizen, that's a problem too, right? So obviously, if it's between, you know, Fortune 500 firms, you know, hiding millions and billions of dollars in these tax havens, then that's the top priority. I think that we also should look at the effects on people, you know, from the United States who are in other countries and figure out a way that targets these big corporations and targets, you know, individuals who are extremely wealthy as well, while still bearing in mind that we don't want to end up hurting people who are not in this situation and who are trying to open bank accounts to start a new life in Europe, for example. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a way of doing it reasonably and rationally that doesn't penalize average people, but is targeting these big corporations or these super wealthy. Nate?
It's even more exploitative of people in poorer countries that, you know, just they're not, their government structure is not solid enough to, you know, crack down on some of these corporate tax avoidances. And I mean, ours isn't either. So, you know, what is someone in, I don't know, like Bangladesh or something going to do when they're not getting, you know, the tax revenues that honestly they should be getting, but rather, you know, it's just being shipped off. If we can't do anything about it or haven't been able to do anything about it recently, you know, there's really any reason to expect that it's going to change in other parts of the world. And yeah, this is going to continue being a form of corruption. I mean, it's just a quote unquote legal way of corruption, or there are plenty of ways to stash your money to avoid paying taxes on it, but doing so legally, I think we just need to work on ways of making sure there aren't these loopholes or aren't these legal ways of stashing money.
I think that in some ways, yeah, these companies are sort of hovering over these developing countries and sort of just vacuuming up money. And then definitely none of that is going back to the governments there or going back to the people there in any real substantive way. And they're certainly not going back in the form of high wages. I mean, that's why, you know, with retail heavy countries, you know, retail production countries, I should say, you know, textiles and things like that, you know, the reason that the companies are there at all is because of the low wage structures and everything. But as Nate said, if we don't lead by example here in the first world, then the third world's definitely not going to get a hold on its tax avoidance situation. And it's you know, it's bad enough when it's illegal. It's just so much worse when it's legal, because then no one has any confidence in the system, right? Because you're like, my government has sold me out, essentially. They've created a legal structure and are refusing to do anything about it. And we talked a little bit about, you know, proposals of how to do various things to try to solve these problems. And some of them have worked and some of them haven't. But, you know, sometimes it really feels like they're not trying, because, you know, the sort of strict end of enforcement would be to, you know, pass rules that say things like, if you have a certain, you know, a certain volume of sales in the United States, you have to pay a certain amount of taxes here in the United States, regardless of that. Or you could do, you know, have some other requirement based on the number of workers, but then they might just ship jobs overseas to avoid, like, you know, there's various reasons why they haven't done the strict things, although I think they need to start looking more seriously at ways of saying, okay, you're clearly not running a gigantic operation in Ireland. You have like 500 people working there. Like, why are you paying all of your taxes through Ireland? Like, that's clearly an effort to avoid, you know, some, you know, that happened with companies like Apple and I think maybe Starbucks or something like that. A lot of these major corporations basically claiming that they're actually based in some other country, right? Or that they have a giant subsidiary in the Cayman Islands that's like making most of their global revenue or something like that. I mean, they're managing to get the benefits of these profits without having to pay, you know, in the U.S., without having to pay the taxes. And I've said this before, if you're going to be taking advantage of the great U.S. legal system that's very favorable toward business and business law, you need to be supporting those kind of institutions. You need to be paying for these things, and you're not doing that if you're stashing trillions of dollars. Also, if you're managing to sit on over $2 trillion without using it for anything, I think we can probably tax you a bit more or compel you to pay workers more, things like that, because clearly you're only doing it to just ramp up your quarterly profits, and then you just don't have any reason for all those profits. You can't find anything to use them on, so you just stash them, but you've used them to be able to show your shareholders that your company is growing or whatever. But again, like I said, some of these efforts have been a total joke. I mean, I don't want to name names, but there have been some Democratic senators that have said, oh, you know, the solution here is to have these amnesties, right? They've got $2 trillion sitting in offshore accounts. Let's have them repatriate the money, but they don't have to pay the full tax rate on it. They just have to pay a smaller amount. And I'm like, why? Why would we do that? Okay, because clearly they've basically just barely skirted the law to be able to do this. And second, that's exactly what they want. They want to play a waiting game to just be like, oh, we'll just wait until they decide to give us an amnesty deal and then we only pay, you know, 1% on it or something ridiculous like that. Or we pay a flat fee for moving hundreds of billions of dollars back into the country. This is just absurd. Why are we pandering to these companies, right? I mean, you can talk about international pressures and intense competition and need to generate profits, and they, you know, that they could just move their production elsewhere or whatever. At the end of the day, where are these companies selling? They're US-based companies that are selling products in the United States. If you have those two components, why are you not paying taxes in the United States? Legally and morally, you have an obligation to pay taxes in the United States.
Companies don't have any moral obligation to pay any money. They want to like keep it in some sort of pool or something, gold coins, and swim around like Scrooge McDuck. I mean, the reason that they're not paying taxes here is because they don't have to. There's no obligation for them. So, I mean, it's just the profit motive, I guess. They're just going to try to find any way of weaseling out of any taxes that, you know, may come to them. I guess they don't really view it as a moral you know, obligation or anything like that. I mean, I think they probably should, but they're not really engaging in society if they're not necessarily contributing or going out of their way to avoid contributing. So it kind of is what it is until we fix the rules, though. That's sort of unfortunate.
Right. We've got to fix the rules. I mean, the stuff that we talk about on this show, you know, the future of living wages, the future of various social programs, none of these things we're going to be able to afford if we haven't fixed the rules regarding corporations and also, as Persephone mentioned, wealthy individuals. You know, I was reading some statistics in the New York Times, specifically on the individual side. This is just talking about income tax, so not anything about, you know, stock earnings or any of that kind of stuff, purely income tax. The top 20% of Americans pay in federal tax on average well more than the entire annual incomes of anyone in the bottom 60%. The top 20% of Americans also average an after-tax income of almost $239,000. So after they've paid all their taxes, the top 20% is still averaging $239,000 a year, which is 4.6 times the after-tax income of everyone in the bottom 60%. There are also 115,000 Americans who make so much money in income alone that they owe $3.3 million in federal income tax on average each year, right? So these are people, individuals, who literally have to write a check to the IRS however many times a year or whatever that adds up to $3.3 million a year. And then there are 12.12 million Americans whose yearly federal income tax payments are equal to the annual income of someone who's right at that bottom 40% threshold of incomes, right? So what I'm saying here, why I'm bringing up those statistics, is that if we're looking at people to be paying, you know, $80,000 or $50,000 in taxes, or in some cases, even, you know, $3.3 million in yearly taxes, we have to also have a way of making sure that we're actually collecting money from these people. And that's just the income side alone. I mean, we can talk about, you know, taxing people with hedge funds and things like that at a fairer rate as well. But we have to have enforcement mechanisms, because otherwise people just get so frustrated and fed up with a system that they can clearly see is not applying the same rules to them as they are applying to the wealthy, right? That it's much stricter enforcement. And you see the sort of backlash in places like Brazil. You don't want our tax system's future to look like Brazil's, where they have, you know, tens of thousands of tax enforcement agents who basically just go around shutting down small businesses and arresting, like, low-income people for not having complied with, you know, X, Y, and Z notarized forms or whatever. Meanwhile, some, you know, oil baron or something, or minerals, you know, guy, or giant agro soy farmer industry guy is making off with, you know, millions of dollars personally or through his corporation, and they're not touching that guy. I mean, you know, there was a whole New York Times article about the Brazilian tax code, which is apparently really insane and just not rationally applied at all. And, like, the best enforcement that they do, which is pretty good enforcement as developing nations go, is basically only targeted at lower income people or businesses, you know, collecting those VATs, the value added tax, which is like a 30% sales tax type of thing. That they're really good at collecting. They're not very good at collecting the money from the wealthiest people. And it's sort of similar in the United States. We get these people, you know, someone who's getting their taxes withheld from their paycheck, Joe Schmo, right? He's not going to be able to avoid taxes particularly unless it's very small amounts, you know, like gambling or whatever, that he's making a little bit of money here and there, right? Maybe he's not paying taxes on that, but otherwise all of his taxes are being collected. Meanwhile, you've got people who are like, well, I actually have all these holdings in Bermuda, and so therefore I'm not obligated to pay taxes on this thing and that thing, whatever. This is how we end up short on money, so to speak. There is money in the system. As I have said before on this show, we have to be willing to go get it. It doesn't belong to these people because they're not following the rules that the rest of us have to follow, and they're not compensating workers. The money exists. We have to go get it. Closing thoughts, Persephone.
I mean, I really don't know what to add to that. I think that everything you said is true. We need this funding. We need this money to fund public projects. And I think that anything we can do, we should be doing.
We need to start with these changes and try to move some of this money back home. As we talked about this issue before, there's really not a whole lot that we can gain from this while we're not actually taking any policy actions to get this money back home. So right now it's just sort of sitting there. I'm imagining, like, the people in these banks, like in the bank branches in the Caribbean, just like hanging out, and they've got like millions in the vault, and they're like gold coins and gold bars and stuff. It's probably got to be pretty good down there.
I'm guessing it's all in like electronic zeros and ones, but it is more fun to imagine it's all in Krugerrands.
There's probably a little bit of bullion.
All right. Nate, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Persephone, thanks for coming back on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8bitanimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.